You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is the second part of my conversation with the fantastic comic and poet Tim Key. So let's talk about the writing of the actual poems. There's loads of other stuff to get onto.
Oh, sure.
But you've got, is there any reason why poem 1742 is on your wall there? Are you standing in here, right, sort of puts me in mind, you're standing in here with two bits of chalk, maybe one in each hand, going, oh, this and then this?
No, the writing process, this is going to be a very small part of the...
Okay, okay, that's fine.
Is, that's just there because... I put them on Instagram now, my poems.
Yes, I've seen that, and it's great. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that before, so, but you've got a brilliant Instagram.
So I put, I wrote that on there, and took a photo of it.
Gotcha.
That's what that is. No, usually writing them is a case of just writing them. There's no rhyme or reason to it.
Okay.
Definitely no rhyme. I just sit down. Oh, God. I do actually work really hard at my writing sometimes, but not in the context of these poems. They're very quick.
Okay.
They just come out.
Do you keep notes as you wander around? And do you see a dog jump through a window and think, oh, dog window poem?
Yeah, I do definitely. I'd note that. I carry a notepad and, but actually, the thing is, I don't note it down. Whether it was a poem, I won't really note it down. I'm more likely to just write the poem.
Because they are so mercifully brief.
So if there's a dog who's doing that, there.
I think it's hilarious you regard them as a crutch somehow.
Yeah, they are. But I don't know. There's sometimes I would write a longer one. But, I mean, it doesn't really take any more or less time because it's just sort of train of thought.
Yeah,
just,
okay.
When I did the Newswipe and things like that, that's different because they're commissioned.
Yes.
As in, they're saying, can you write a poem about, you know, whatever, the Syria? And you're like, well, that feels like something I'm going to have to think about a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I would think about it and try and write something shatteringly satirical.
Okay.
Just, it's... I find it easier to write about, like, a lady who's stewing some plums than I find it to write about something that's,
yes,
like, you know, the banking crash or something.
Do you find that there are certain topics that you head towards? Do you think...
Oh, yeah, I do. I always...
What sort of things are in your wheelhouse? What sort of things do you find yourself often...
I find myself... There's a lot of death. There's a lot of... people being left out.
Yes, okay.
Dinner
parties?
There's a lot of dinner parties. There's a lot of people coming back, and I don't know why that is. I've noticed that recently. There'd just be a bloke who's just come back, and everyone's fed up. There's a lot of people who come back. There's a lot of people doing some eccentric things with animals. People eat some pretty bad stuff. There's a lot of people in love,
mm-hmm.
I think.
But that's the, those are things that you've noticed yourself coming back to rather than any subjects you've gone towards.
No, there's never subjects I've gone towards. I wrote I wrote a book of them, and as part of that, it became a kind of chapters thing. So I for the first time, looked at, I sort of was confronted with them. And it's quite easy to think, well, obviously, probably there'll be a chapter probably about relationships or dating, marriage, things like that. But then there was a chapter about rascals, which was, you know, again, plenty. Need to write.
Yeah, okay.
There's one about heroes. Again, there was one about jobs. So I guess there's quite a lot of things where I just assign someone a job and say what they're up to. And then as part of that, I think there's like, I found there was a lot that was set at night, and so, but not enough. So then started to write just about night.
Okay.
So I do sometimes do that. When I do a show, I did that last show, and I knew that I was going to use a bed. So I wrote loads of poems about beds,
mm-hmm.
which is very, it's always quite fun because then you preview it and you don't have a bed. You're just
okay. You know,
inexplicably, this person who's suddenly writing everything is about beds for no good reason at all.
And obviously, I hear what you're saying, that they're that it's a short, you know, they tumble out of you, and they're, you know, you don't spend much time writing on them. But compared to those ones in that YouTube video from 2005,
yeah.
How do you think your writing ability has changed since then? Because like, the stuff you write now, I mean, would you say the stuff you write now is better than the stuff you started writing? And if so, how?
Well, what I tried to do... No, I don't think it is. What I tried to do is each show, I always try and make sure... When I started writing, I wrote 227 in a notepad and filled that before I even said any of them. I didn't tell anyone I did that.
You wrote 227 different poems?
Yeah.
In a notepad?
In a notepad, like just on the tube instead of reading.
Okay.
I just wrote these poems. And so each poem is the same length. And those ones are probably a lot of the ones I was reading at that thing. But what I try and do is with each show, there's at least one from those first 227. And they're slightly different. Like the most recent five that I've written probably all will have some kind of, be more peculiar, be more maybe like jokey. There'd be more, something more discernible that you can get your teeth into and think, that's a bit like a joke, maybe. Some of them. Or they're more, I don't know, I've never really sort of placed them next to each other. But I know that they're slightly different, but I don't know exactly how. But I used to like those really early ones, that nothing would happen. Just be like some old men drinking cider and then drinking cider and then packing away their games and going their separate ways. Well, these sort of peculiar things where part of it was, I think part of the joke back then was, I mean, why document the...
Why
document these incidents?
And that joke is still valid?
Sometimes, yeah.
But,
other times, these days, there'll be a poem where you don't think, why has he documented that incident? Because you're thinking instead, that's a funny poem.
And is that because your performance ability has changed? I mean, it must have in 10 years worth of performing comic poetry.
Yeah.
You must have got better at them.
No, I don't know. I don't think I have. I got different at it.
Okay.
I would say that, no, I definitely haven't got better. Back then, when you're doing it for the first time, and I would split rooms more. And so I'm doing it differently, but not better. Like in 2005, 2006, it was just really a really fun thing to do. I had that that complete kind of anonymity where no one would have a clue, obviously, what I was about. But not like a couple would know. No one would know because I hadn't done it. And so then it becomes a very different game from now. I'm very lucky that I have an audience. If I do an Edinburgh show or, you know, if I do a preview, I'm really lucky. I kind of count my lucky stars that I have that. It's very nice. And it allows you more freedom. should do. I think it does allow you more freedom. But it also, I don't know, I don't have it quite clear in my head how much responsibility you have to make sure it's all fine.
Yes.
And I don't know. I really don't know exactly what my take on the sort of 10 years apart is.
Mm.
But I know I really liked that first year. Sometimes it wouldn't go so well. But I think it was, I mean, I think part of it was I was sort of getting used to the idea that I was reading them all for the first time, and I was as startled as everyone else that this could be an act.
Yeah.
I think everyone in the room is sort of thinking, now, how is this fine? Including me, I'm sort of there going, well, I don't know, because the person before me has absolutely written some jokes, and the person after me has really sorted himself out. And in between, I'm reading some... I'm doing something different, which I quite enjoy. And then the audiences responded really well. Like, the audience enjoy it as well. But like I say, there would also be some measure of division in the audience. Not devastatingly, but, you know, it wouldn't be like... I'm not saying that it was a car crash, but five people were loving it. It wasn't like that, but there was certainly more kind of... it was slightly more colourful atmosphere in the audience. You know, I think now, if I go on in front of 100 people, my aim is absolutely that I really hope these 100 people like this stuff.
If you regard the poems, sometimes even, as a crutch, is that the same as saying that you would rather be the sort of stand-up like Mark, for example? Would you rather be able to go out there with some stories and some jokes that you'd written and improvised and worked on, and you had no props and no cards?
No, I wouldn't rather be. I do feel very lucky that I have an act. That's my act.
Yeah.
And I have found a way of doing it. So no, I obviously watch people and think, wow, that's inspired me to work harder. But I don't tend to watch and think, like, you know, even stuff that I love, like Mark, or watching Alex's last show. Just, yeah, I just watch and think it's great that he does it his way and I do it my way. Very vive la différence. Has to be. Like, I watched Kim Noble and just think, Jesus, I mean, I don't know how he does that. No idea. And it's amazing. And I have not a massive amount of interest in, you know, swapping. I mean, there's practical things about it where the idea of arriving at a gig with no need for poems, music, suit. I guess there's a few props that I need. I have a sort of armour and weaponry that I have to have. But I don't sort of ever, don't really lose sleep over it. I think it's worse when, it goes in waves, doesn't it, of how confident you feel. Right now I kind of feel okay about it because I haven't done it for a while. So, and when I last did it, it was all fine.
Yeah.
And so I kind of feel quite optimistic that it should be okay. It should be all fine again. So if there are bits where you're less confident with it all, then I suppose at those times you look at other people and think, oh, I wish I had their act. But what you're really saying is, I wish I was on top of my own act.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think that's very insightful. Let's talk quickly about the... what's the impetus behind the... You know, if we're talking about bringing things to the gig, obviously there's a bath or a bed or an incredibly involved... I mean, in your toilet, there is on your toilet wall, there is a framed picture of the 3-person sub-aquatic camera shoot required for that show, which is a brilliant picture that I feel privileged to have seen. It's amazing. What's the impetus behind And I'm thinking also in terms of like the beginning. I mean, am I allowed to give things away?
I think
it's a couple of years ago. Beginning of the show, I think it was Master Slap, where there was a lookalike. You were on stage and walking in and out on stage as we came in.
Yeah.
And then we watched you and suddenly you were impossibly behind us and it must have been a lookalike.
Yeah.
This is all incredible, brilliant stuff. Where does it come from in you? Why do you want to be doing that?
Well, I think the thing is, with that show, I had an idea. It's all about whether you have an idea. If you have an idea, I guess these days I work in such a way where, or make a show where if I have a good idea that's like that, rather than the good idea, which is just a good idea to say something, then it's a possibility for me, I think, because I also have like people who I work with who can help make that happen. And so, like, the bath, I kind of thought, I think part of it is I want to make a really good show. And I think with that one, the show before had been a success, and I felt a pressure on myself to make sure my next show was as good as that one.
Okay.
For me, that I liked it as much. And so I had this idea came to me, I think, in the bath, of having a bath in the show. And my plan was that when the audience were coming in, there'd just be a bath on stage, a hot bath with bubbles and steam rising. And then once everyone's in and we get clearance, the lights come down and there's just a spotlight on the bath and I come out of the bath.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that'd be a nice way to start a show where after that people would be confident that I had some good ideas.
Yeah.
And it didn't actually end up like that. That wasn't how I used the bath in the end.
Did you ever try doing that? Because that seems replete with its own...
No, that would have had issues, yeah, including obviously my death. Death what I did instead was I just had a bath and then got in the bath. Submerged myself, mm-hmm, disappeared into the bath. And I just sensed that would be a nice thing to do.
And so, if I'm remembering correctly, you climb into the bath, yeah, chasing a can of Ruddles.
Yeah, I do that.
And then we see you on a projector screen, and it's actually you swimming in this glorious, yeah, well-lit, professionally filmed,
yeah,
you know, subaquatic environment.
Yeah.
Whilst you are then hiding in the bath using an oxygen canister to remain underwater.
By and large, holding my breath, actually.
Really? Okay. A tube would probably also have worked.
Yeah, well, actually, no, the way to do it would have been a tube that comes out. Yeah, I designed it in my head about a year after finishing the show. Yeah. Yeah, there must have been a way of doing that. Yeah, but basically, all of it comes from that one idea of coming out of the bath at the start of a show, which didn't happen. After that, once you've got people... welding two baths together to make a big bath, then you're at liberty to think about how you can use the bath. Then, actually, it's probably got quite a lot in common with writing, where, yes, you're sort of working out how this all works. So then, with the bath, there's another thing of structure, I suppose. The show before, I had films which would run through the show, and I really, really liked that because it sort of gave me a moment between these sort of, in my mind, they were kind of almost acts.
Mm-hmm.
I once wrote that word down. That's lucky it's not on there, is it? I don't have acts on there. But yeah, sometimes I did, in my mind, think of them as acts, where get the introduction done, then film, then this bit of stuff with these poems and this other thing that fitted in with that, and then film, and then I would introduce what this section was about. And so the whole thing felt more more structured than it would have done if I'd just done it in exactly the same order but without, mm-hmm, the films. And so with the bath, I used it then for that I didn't like put one show there and put the next show next to it and match up and try and replace good things in my last show with equivalents. But at the end I did, and it was kind of remarkable how similar they were, really.
Yes.
And so, yeah, with the bath, instead of just walking into the back, into the gloom and the film coming on the screen,
mm-hmm.
I would just disappear into the bath, and that was, I imagine, quite interesting to watch.
I mean, it's not just interesting to watch, is it? You must have known or subsequently discovered that moments like that make people go, whoa!
No, not that part of it. No, I don't think so. I mean, I hope that people are thinking that, but it's quite funny because I don't get any of that because I'm in the bath.
Well, yes.
I come out of the bath, I don't get whoa anymore. I get people looking at me thinking, how's he going to cope with the fact that he's wet?
Sure, but you might not receive the woe, but you must be able to visualise, like, when that happens.
Yeah.
Surely, okay, let's be purely cynical about this. Is part of you thinking, that's got to be an extra star?
If I'd done a rubbish show with that happening, then it doesn't get you an extra star. It's just like, okay, I mean, why... you write a funny show. Why has he got a bath? You know, there's no... I think it only works as part of a balanced diet. It has
okay,
to be.
Okay.
There's no point in doing that. I would, if I walked on stage and absolutely died on my ass for 15 minutes and then had a bath, people wouldn't be thinking, well, they'd be like, yeah, stay in the bath. And then when I come out of the bath, they'd be like, what are you doing? The bath, get in the bath. We'll be fine with you in the bath. But yeah, I don't ever think of it like that. I kind of, there's probably an element of security in it
mm-hmm.
that I kind of feel like if that was all working, then I know I have a lot of faith that my show has a sort of a beginning, a middle and an end. And I know that it can work as a thing, and also there's stuff that's ready to happen. That's kind of, I know that those bits at least will work, even if there's any kind of lull in my bit. But it also means that I'm just doing 10 minutes, and I'm coming into it with a bit of momentum.
Yes.
And I know what I'm doing in those bits, and I know that. As we tick down to the moment I go into the bath again, that the stuff that I filmed is very pretty, and so yeah. But like for example, this at the moment I'm trying to maybe build a new hour up, but I don't have an idea like that, so it's not. So I probably won't have it.
Uh-huh.
And in that bath one, I remember my main thing was I thought I won't have any films, and then I thought of that idea of the underwater stuff. So I think you have to be quite flexible, but yeah, if I thought of something that was, you know, the equivalent of a bath situation like that,
yes,
which I did in the last show, I had something which I thought, yeah, that I really love that idea,
yeah,
and then. Just sort of threw myself into it, but I don't know how you think of those ideas.
No,
I don't think you can.
Okay, I
don't think you can. I don't think you can sort of go, well, I think I'll spend a day on that. I mean, you can sort of walk around your flat looking at bits of furniture and thinking maybe this show is about sofas, but after a while, I think people will probably cotton on to you.
So this is Tim, the second hour from Tim here. We actually recorded for longer than 2 hours, but I've tried to whittle down the best bits. Loads more fascinating stuff here. I hope you're enjoying it. Thanks for all your feedback on the first episode. Remember, you can tweet about the show. You can tweet at me at ComComPod, or you can email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Feel free to share this around. There's loads of different ways you can help the show. I know some of you like donating, and those are very much appreciated. Your donations can come via PayPal at comedianscomedian.com. You can click on the PayPal button and support the show with a pound a show, a one-off donation of 5, 10, 20 pounds, or whatever else you think you would like to pay. Your donations keep the show free for people who can't afford it. So thank you very much to everyone that has recently. Feel free to continue doing that.
There's just one or two little things. Oh, that was it. I wanted to mention the Soho run again. So very, very excited to be working in conjunction with Soho Theatre. The first Tuesday of the month of the next 4 months, we have got some brilliant guests. Now, lots of people have been asking me who the guests are. I think we're going to release the names nearer the time because we're going for some quite high profile people. And it's very difficult to get people of that calibre locked in 2 months ahead of time. And I don't want to announce a name and then disappoint you. And I understand that means that only a very small hardcore percentage of you will rush to the internet now and book tickets. That's absolutely fine. We will be bringing you those names as soon as they're locked in and confirmed. And we'll do one at a time, I think, most likely. We'll get back to Tim Key, really. There's not a huge amount else to say. I'm completely submerged in preview week at the moment. I've been trying to recreate the brilliant time I had at the New Zealand International Comedy Festival last year, previewing my show, when it's just such a privilege to do a preview every night, write the show all the next day, and then do a preview again. So I've tried to recreate that with a run of previews. The first one at Top Secret last night was amazing. Really looking forward to the Backyard tonight. Thanks to everyone that's coming along to those, and the Pleasants tomorrow night as well. I realise I'm saying this on Tuesday and you won't hear it till at least Thursday, probably Friday, but let's assume they all went swimmingly. The first one certainly did. I'm very, very pleased about that. I also appeared recently on Pappy's Flatshare Slamdown, which is a fantastic podcast by Pappy's. You'll know them from Bad Alts on BBC Three and also from their terrific back catalogue, as it were, of live shows. Really exciting shows. And I found out from them last night that Tom Parry is taking his show up to the Edinburgh Festival, his debut hour, and Matthew Crosby is going to be up there with his second one. Those are both very, very fine comedians. So you heard it here first, if you heard it here first. But download our episode of Flatshare Slamdown. It's a brilliant game show concept podcast where I am competing with Lou Sanders, also of this parish. So she was fantastic and literally threw a glass at the floor and smashed it within 2 seconds of being on stage. So really good fun. Listen out for that. Also this weekend, I'm going to be on Josh Widdicombe's XFM radio show, which is also a podcast. And also I'm going to be a guest on Rob Deering as he takes over for James Acaster on a FUBAR radio show. So it's all nice and interconnected this week, which is lovely, which is good for me because all I'm doing all day, every day is scribbling and then desperately trying to remember all the scribbles. I'm in post-it note heaven at the moment. So let's go back to the nerve center. This is Tim Key.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The secret to visibly firmer, summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dull, dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Rich yet never greasy, Andaria Algae Body Oil is formulated with sustainably sourced seaweed to help replenish the skin's moisture barrier and 7 nourishing active botanical oils for results you can see and feel all over. The best part? Its signature scent. A blend of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. This all-natural scent is unforgettable. Everything Osea makes is clean, vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Your solo projects, because I know you're connected to Party, and I know obviously with Freeze, with Basden, with Tom Basden, I think I know well enough to start banding around a surname like
Basden
you
do. Will do.
Basden will do. And the short film you made together. There's kind of those kind of collaborative interests. Do you find when you're working on your own, you sort of mentioned a few times walking around the flat, and you live in this flat on your own, and you've got the nerve center here. Do you get lonely when you're?
It's important that the people know that the nerve center is your term.
Yeah, I will cut the bit at the beginning when I say the word nerve center first. Yeah,
I don't have a sign on it saying that. Do I get lonely? Not. Depends what you mean by lonely, really. Not lonely, but, you know, you sometimes go out of your mind slightly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very useful to have a balance, I think. I'm very grateful that I do have people I work with. And then there's good and bad things about both things. What's quite liberating about doing a show on your own is you don't have any discussions where you're trying to be diplomatic because you think one thing and they think something else, which can be exhausting. I mean, I think I'm quite fortunate with Basden that we have a very good working relationship, and it's usually quite, you know, it's usually based on working in different countries and based on writing and actual writing rather than ideas. A lot of the time it's like, so you can sort of see it in action rather than have circular conversations about how your show is going to be. So, but nonetheless, when you do your show on your own, there's none of that at all. And, you know, obviously the all of the failures you have to suck up on your own, but you also do feel quite pleased when you present a bit of work that you've made.
The failures aren't really very apparent these days.
Yeah, well, I don't sort of put them out on Facebook.
Like, you, I suppose from the outside, it looks like you're someone who, you know, it's all going off for you at the moment, isn't it? And it has been for some time. I mean, you've just done this play with Kitson,
yeah,
which was great. I mean, that must have been fun to do.
Yeah, that ties in with that last conversation, as in, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's very enjoyable to collaborate, and collaborating live was a very nice thing to do.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you both looked like you were really enjoying yourselves.
Yeah, it was really enjoyable. We'd pitch up at 7 o'clock every night and have that kind of hour before as a, you know, an hour with, you know, friends rather yeah. than an hour where you're just sort of almost dead.
And not that when you're almost dead, well, what are you referring to?
Before going on stage.
I see, okay.
But then, you know, I actually don't mind the hour before I go on stage on my own either. I don't mind that, but it's definitely enjoyable to have to work with someone like that. Tree was fun.
Do you see your influence in other newer comics?
Well,
what was that laugh?
Oh, because someone sent me something of someone that had done something.
Oh, I look forward to finding out who that is after we've finished recording.
Yeah. But do I see it? No, because I don't think I watch enough. Are you talking about, like, new comics doing open mic
stuff? Tinky-ish stuff.
Yeah. No, I sometimes...
Like, new or newer?
I sometimes get a text from someone saying, oh, well, this guy's a fan of yours.
Yeah. I've seen a lot more poems around these days.
Have you?
A lot more short poems with... you know, names like Jeff and Tanya. And
have you?
I feel a little bit like I have.
Yeah.
Not a lot more, but just I've had that thing of going, oh, Fanny Keith.
I mean, I sort of feel slightly heaven help them. I mean, it's not... I don't think it's a gimme that it's going to be right for everyone to read short poems. I haven't seen much of it, but I do know what you mean, and I kind of... I suppose it is the whole sincerest form of flattery
mm-hmm.
stuff, isn't it? I always think, well, that's fine. I don't really mind it. But I think the problem would be if I felt, you know, insecure in my own career, where, you know, what I was doing. If I felt like I was broke... and it had all gone wrong, and I was overlooked, and then I saw some scumbag reading some scrap of paper about a man called Jeff on telly, then I'd sort of think, oh, God, he's got my career. But no, I don't really... I mean, I suppose it's sort of a thing that will happen, isn't it? Because it is kind of... is quite discernible. You can see when someone reads a poem more than, you know, there's plenty of good comedians who maybe wouldn't even notice that someone is doing their stuff because, you know, that it's not quite as cut and dry that that's their thing.
Mm-hmm.
With my one, it is not that it's my thing, because I'm sure, well, other people did read poems before and will read them after. But obviously, if I see someone unfurl a tiny scrap of paper, or, I mean, I think it would put the tin lid on it if they read it off a pornographic playing card. But you can't, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't sort of go, well, that's my thing, so no one else can do it now. And like I say, I haven't really seen it so much.
Yeah. You mentioned were you afraid of being overlooked? So you're clearly not afraid of being overlooked. And it's interesting, that word overlooked, I think, that's kind of one of the core fears at the heart of a lot of comedians.
Yeah, career-wise. Totally.
Like, you're obviously not overlooked. You're very much celebrated for what you're doing at the moment. I wasn't meaning to be kind of portentous about your future. But, you do lots with the Invisible Dot.
Yeah.
And you presumably have, like, they're cool. They're cool. Like, that's their whole brand. They're cool.
Yeah.
And you're cool. Like, you work with Kitson. He's that untouchable guy.
Yeah, that was.
And do you know what I mean?
Definitely a cool move.
That's cool, right?
Yeah, really cool.
What's it like being cool?
Good. Yeah. I mean, I think the trick is not to talk about it. But that felt very cool. The Kitson thing was that felt like a real cool move. But it's mainly just kind of. There are bits where you just think, yeah, that's a good thing that's happened. But, you know, it's like, from the outside looking in, people would say this to most comedians, that sort of seems to be sort of ticking along. And actually, when you live my bit, there's bits where there's disappointments and there's bits where, you know, it's really enjoyable, you know. I mean, I feel I have no real complaints because... I've got a lot of stuff that I'm really pleased with and proud of. But obviously there's bits where, you know, it didn't quite work out, and there's bits where where you try to do something and it doesn't come off and things.
What are some of those things where you have... Like, something I'm fond of asking people is, what skills do you feel that you don't have? What things do you see other people do and go, I wish I was better at that bit of the job or that... approach?
Oh, right. Well, I definitely have some of those. I mean, I don't know. Confidence is a big thing, isn't it? And sometimes I feel really very confident, and other times less so. And then you look at other comedians and you think, oh, they're pretty much confident all the time. However, I would say probably other comedians could easily look at me and think, he seems pretty confident.
Yes, sure.
So, you know, we're all sort of racked with self-doubt and have enormous sense of our own abilities, and then a sort of complete catastrophic feeling that we're totally, utterly worthless.
Do you go through those?
Of course. Yeah. I'm not in one right now. I'm not going to sort of put one in the podcast. That's what you're after.
Can you text me next time you're in one? No, but you, I mean, what do you do to get yourself out of those? Because I mean, this, you know, listeners of my show will know that this is a huge deal for me. Like, I'm constantly racked with self-doubt. Not a day goes by and I somehow drag myself out of it. What do you do when you're... Well, I mean, can you really have moments of self-doubt when you have had such success? Like, what else is there that you could want to have that you don't have? Career-wise?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you can have incredible lows. I mean, the thing is, if you just do a show where it doesn't go well, then that's enough. I mean, I've definitely had bits where I felt like I've got to just stop doing it because I can't, you know, I feel like I can't do it anymore. But I don't think that's any different from anyone. I've got, you know, good friends who are comedians who would say the same thing, and you just go, well, that doesn't make any sense because you're just an amazing comedian, and like you've just said today, everything seems to be all, you know, you got some really nice posters. But I did one in Kilkenny. I went to Kilkenny, and the whole thing just the wheels came off, and I couldn't do it anymore. And I think the three worst gigs of my life, one after another, and to the point where I had no idea, I was like a shell of a man, and from nowhere. And I did know that after that, in terms of getting out of it, it took a little while because it was a pretty bruising experience. And I suppose what you take away from it is that one thing I take away from it is that I'll never get to there, to that bit where it can't go wrong.
Yeah, okay.
And that's not because... I don't know why that is. I think just... Sometimes it can go wrong. I mean, it went spectacularly wrong in Kilkenny.
When you said it went so wrong that you couldn't continue, do you mean like you stopped a show halfway through?
No, I got to the end of it, but these shows were about 20 minutes, and the last one, having been bruised and battered by these two gigs before, I walked on, and I had this... when I walk on stage, I often bring a can of beer... And I open it, and it goes everywhere. And first I throw it on the floor in a bag, and take my tie out of the bag, put my tie on, pick the beer up, and then open the beer, and the beer goes everywhere. Anyway, the last gig I did in Kilkenny, I walked on, I dropped the bag, and I just didn't back myself to be able to pick it back up. I just thought, that's gone. And then I just carried on to the mic, and I started with my strongest poem from the last decade that I'd stopped doing about 3 years before that because it was old now. And I started with that and got nothing and just realised I had nothing now. And I was on stage for 20 minutes and there was no booing or anything like that. I just played to silence. And
presumably if they don't get it...
Yeah.
It's not like... I mean, it must be quite a weird thing for you doing poems when they don't get it, because do you think they're thinking, this guy's a poet, why is he in the comedy festival? Do you think that's...
Yeah, but I don't think they were... I think it's more like a comedian dying than a... I think you could still see when I'm reading them out that I'm trying to read out, this is my act. I think they could still see, his thing is funny poems, and this is not funny. And so this is a slight shame.
And do you have any gears in that circumstance? Obviously, on that particular occasion...
I don't have
occasion,
any gears on that. Yeah, in that circumstance, I do. Yeah, definitely. I've done it quite a lot of times. So, you know, you can have bits where you think, oh, dear, this is... I need to, like, do something different here. That's all fine. But I wasn't in that kind of... Like, at the moment, I am, as you talk to me, looking quite sort of... least optimistic and impish when I'm telling you this story as a person who had to go and do a show tonight will be able to do it. That day I was fated to not be able to do it. I mean, I was in my hotel room looking at these poems on the bed and just looking at them and just going, it was like I suddenly realised that I just was a general in command of 30 absolutely shit soldiers. And I just was looking at them and just thinking, I can't do that one. I mean, what am I... Because once you do lose confidence... it was a really, really speedy transition. I was, you know, doing merrily, bopping along before. And then I got there and I did a gig that didn't go so well. Then another one that went a bit better. Then another one that went terribly. Then the worst gig of my life. Then the worst gig of my life. And this is now the third one. And so in that position, if I look at all of my stuff now, all of my poems, I'll smile away, look at these poems, think, yeah, that's quite funny, I'll do that one. These ones, I just look, once you're in that mindset, you're looking at them thinking, Well, I mean,
this won't save me. This won't save me. This won't save me.
How am I expecting this poem about a cuckoo to do any good? And why are people going to enjoy the fact that this person's called June? And so I put them all in my little bag and I walked down there and David O'Doherty was headlining, I think. Yeah. And he said that he'd never seen anything like it. I walked on stage and he said, you look like a ghost.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's the thing, and I really transmitted that to everyone.
Yes.
And I did it, and bless my little heart, and then I left, and, yeah, it was pretty bleak because you were thinking, I don't know what happens next time I go on stage, and... I kind of thought I was just trying to work out a strategy of I wrote down like a when I got back to my hotel room I wrote down how I felt. I never read it since, but I thought it was like important to just document it. But I was basically writing stuff about it wasn't a suicidal thing, but it was sort of suicidal in terms of career. It was like, maybe I can't do it anymore. And
it's incredible how quickly you can get to that vivid state of thinking, oh, I really was just lucky for the last 10 years.
Totally. And kind of, when you put it that way, there's some evidence going the other way. But at the time, you're thinking very cogently. You're thinking in quite a mature way. I was thinking, well, I mean, it's not overreacting to think that if I do two more back in London that are like that, what's going to happen in the third one? How am I turning it around if I'm feeling like this? And you know, that was, I don't know when that was, a few years ago. Anyway, what the point is, I still had quite a lot of those posters and things. Mm-hmm. And my career was still all fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you never know when it can, you know, when it can hit you. And when it does, it can be pretty earth-shatteringly bad.
Let's talk about working with Steve Coogan.
Happier, yeah.
Go on.
No, that is a happier thing.
the listenership has all just leant forwards on its oxblood sofa and gone.
They can lean forward.
Oh, really?
yeah. Well, there's not really much to say. It's the same as... it was probably much more interesting to sort of for me to say how close I was to... throwing myself off a cliff after Kilkenny. The Steve Coogan thing is that they asked me to do to be an Alan Partridge, which is much less interesting because that's something good that's happened to me.
Yeah.
That's more like cool, isn't it?
It is cool.
Yeah.
I feel the responsibility to my listenership to ask you about what it's like working with that.
I feel the responsibility to tell them. I'm all for your listenership.
I know that I would rather talk to you about awful doom-mongering bleak moments where you wanted to top yourself
to
an engineer.
I don't think I can talk about that stuff anymore, so I think we're good to talk about Steve Coogan.
That was my intent.
Well, you know, there's a new series of Mid Morning Matters come out in the summer. He's very nice. We have a professional relationship.
Okay.
I once stayed in his house in the Lake District. So, yeah, we get on fine, thank you. they asked me to do it about whenever that was, 5 or 6 years ago. And, yeah, it's a very surreal thing because probably like your listenership or your...
I'm feeling now like my listenership is like a nickname for my one listener.
Yeah, your wife.
Yeah.
So your listenership should know that he's, he's obviously an amazing... comedian. And it's quite a weird thing to like that cliche of having, you know, front row seats at the best show in town. It is kind of like that, where I am right next to not just Steve Coogan but Alan Partridge, which is kind of a direct hit. Because probably like you, when I was sort of 17, I was just listening to Know Me, Knowing You again and again and again, and knew all of the this is the, his TV show, his radio show, not the mm-hmm. ABBA song. Mm-hmm. that would have been awful. No, actually, I quite like that. I like ABBA. But yeah, I was listening to it again and again and again and quoting from it. And then all of that, then going on to telly and then on the hour and the day to day. It was kind of, and then the sitcom and stuff, it was kind of on tap for about, yeah. I don't know, about six or seven years, which was amazing. So I loved it. And then to sort of have this weird moment 10 years later where you're asked to do it is very, very surreal.
I would worry that were I to be asked something similar, I would be paralysed by fear and unable to speak, let alone improvise funny stuff.
Well, the good thing is that it's the sort of... I'm bad at making decisions about doing things, but...
Why is that?
I don't know. I'm indecisive, which is another way of saying it.
yeah,
okay. I don't know why.
Are you worried that you'll make the wrong decision?
Yeah, totally. I'm worried that I'll do something which is rubbish or turn something down, which goes on to be excellent,
okay.
obviously, like anyone who's making sure. choices. And so with this one, at least there's no choice to be made because you can't... The idea of not doing it, you can't really push that through.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
To your 18-year-old self. You have to sort of go, okay, well, I'm doing it, so let's work out a way of coping with the situation that you described. And so I said I'd do it. And then, yeah, it's really difficult because I remember the first day doing it and leaving, thinking, you know, worrying that you've potentially brought down the empire. That's the thing. It's a position of great responsibility. And so I kind of feel like...
the kid that played Anakin Skywalker.
yeah, totally. I mean, I do my best in it, but I think you do me a service to say that I'm kind of being funny and improvising. There's a bit of improvising, but I do sort of feel... I mean, I genuinely, guys, I do my best, but it is more like a... you know, it's something for Alan Partridge to have in that room. I guess it's like I'm a device as well as being a character. Not that, you know, I enjoy playing that character, but I'm there as a conduit to put that monster through and for him to bounce off and stuff. And because I think it probably would work if it was just him on his own, but maybe not, because he it would just be phone calls and him just going mad. But, yeah, I'd probably stand by that. I think it probably would work. But to have a person with him just means that he can then go off in different directions.
Yes, but you're not entirely a straight man. You're not entirely a foil. You know, you're very funny in your own right.
Well, it's an amazing job to do because it's no acting at all, as in I am playing someone who cannot believe that he's in this situation.
okay.
Is staggered by the person that he's sat next to.
Yes.
And that's more or less what I am in real life. Like, there's a bit where he sacks me in Mid Morning Matters, and he's yelling at me and yelling at me. And, I mean, I've watched it, and it, like, in my eyes, I look like I'm absolutely, I'm all over the place because of this. Obviously, it's like a huge moment for this character that he's getting berated like this. But actually, like on the day, it's more me at the time just thinking, now how is this happening?
Steve, this bollocking is Steve the best Coogan. Moment of my life.
Like Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge is just yelling at me, and I'm like, so yeah, it's quite a, it's a very odd job. But you know, really. I'm very kind of I'm in a position of privilege, and I do feel privileged to do it.
You say you were asked to do that. Were you asked to do Inside number 19?
Yeah.
You were asked to do it as well. Are you not actively seeking acting work?
I'm actively seeking acting work, and I'm terrible at auditions.
Okay.
So everything that you will have seen me in, I have more or less been offered it, and that's not in any way a kind of arrogant if they offer me it, I'll do it. It's more, you just, there's a parallel career somewhere where I'm good at auditions.
Yeah, okay.
Where, you'd see me regularly as this guy who's got the part in, you know, whatever, the thick of it.
Okay. Which role did you audition for?
I don't know. It was before it went on. It was like right at the start.
Okay. I see.
And one of those things where you sort of go there and just think, well, this would be a good one to get. I'd like to do this. But yeah, I'm genuinely terrible at auditions.
Okay.
I'm sure I've gone into audition rooms where people have sort of gone, oh, we'll get him in because
yes.
I like the look of him. Yeah, as in there's like a chance I could get the part.
Okay.
And I'll sort of do my little bit and then I'll sort of look at them and there'll be this sort of embarrassed hush in the room.
Yeah.
Where we all know what's gone on. I go around just sort of unauditioning for things.
Yeah. So I mean, this go on.
I just sort of go there and it's almost like they've asked me and I've sort of gone along for a couple of hours just to rule myself out in person.
This does beg the obvious question. What's the biggest thing you've ever blown out of your arse audition-wise? What's the biggest myth?
I'm sure there must be good...
Like The Hobbit or something?
No.
I feel like lots of British comics wrote The Hobbit.
I don't think there's any films particularly. Oh, God. Maybe there are. I think what I've done is blocked them all out.
Okay.
But I know for a fact that I've gone for them. I mean, I go for these auditions and I really try and learn it. And then... And my first one was Dr. Zhivago. That was the first one I did for this TV adaptation of Dr. Zhivago with maybe Keira Knightley, something like that.
Uh-huh.
This was in 2001. And I think that's the thing. Now I'm very, obviously, philosophical about auditions because I'm just horseshit at them. But then I remember doing that whole kind of, you know, Tim Roth in Reservoir Dogs thing of just being in this car park, just learning my lines and just walking around this car park near Waterloo, just learning my lines and just going up in the lift thinking, oh, this will really change things if I'm playing this leading character in Dr. Zhivago on ITV. And then just sort of being in there and doing it and leaving. Oh, the guy took a call. The cast director took a call while I was doing it. So, okay, that's not a good sign. Anyway, I left just thinking, right, it's going to be a really difficult career. It's like really hard to do.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so that's a definite limitation for me.
I have two more questions and then I'll let you go. One is about cowards.
Oh, yeah.
Cowards is great. Cowards is... I've used it as an example more than once in the episodes of this podcast that I've done. That was a terrible sentence. I'm going to do that again.
No, I don't mind it.
I'll keep it in the episodes of the things I've done. I use it as an example of the moments when I'm feeling, oh, Christ, what's the point? If Cowards can't get a full-length series, if that show couldn't get a full thing... then what's the fucking point?
Well,
so please tell me there's some underlying thing whereby one of you fucked a producer or something went horribly wrong. Tell me it wasn't just that. They just dropped it.
Well, I don't know what it was, really. I mean, I definitely didn't fuck a producer.
I don't know why that came to me.
I know it came to you, but also you were pointing at me. What happened was... Look, the thing about that is I'm very, again, philosophical about it. But it was difficult. It was very difficult at the time. Now I'm really kind of... I think you're churlish if you've been able to make it and then you're... You know, you can't be too downhearted that you made three because you made three.
This is... I've just realised we haven't explained what it is for people who in other countries who haven't heard of it. So a sketch show.
Delightful
with,
sketch show.
You, Stephen Lloyd and Tom.
Tom Basden. Yeah. And so basically... What happened was we did it in Edinburgh, and it was a really enjoyable thing to do because we were all younger and living in each other's pockets and writing loads. That was kind of learning how to write, I guess. And we would do new shows every month, The Hen and Chickens, And then a new show every Edinburgh. And when I say every Edinburgh, it makes us sound like we were stalwarts, but we did two. And then we got a radio show. Then we got a BBC Three pilot, which was, it also involved us taking over the BBC Three website, which is a very peculiar, it was the sort of thing where you're simultaneously saying, yeah, okay, and also, sorry, what do you mean?
Yes, I remember that.
It was very odd.
I remember seeing, it was all white and yeah, sort of animated and stuff.
We were all shot from above.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah, I think it was, I think we did a sterling job.
Yeah.
Anyway, what you're talking about is then after that they commissioned us to make three. And so we made three episodes and we worked very hard. It was a pilot, it was called a pilot series. So I guess the idea is they look at it and then decide whether they want the series. And we did it. And I just, my big thing about it was a very weird time to stop us, because I felt like them not having faith in us, losing faith in us at any other point. We made this BBC Three pilot. It wasn't quite right. And I think at that point, if they'd said, yeah, I don't think it's quite going to happen, but, you know, keep up your live stuff, then I think it would have been less perplexing, actually, in a way. It was the fact they got us to do those three for BBC Four. And then we did them okay, I think. And the director was great. And then I remember them editing it and us seeing a version and thinking it's not quite right, I don't know. But then we saw a final version. And at that point I thought, yeah, actually pretty proud of that. And then it went on telly. And then it got really good reviews. And a lot of people really liked it. But they're just, obviously they're people who I know. So obviously they're, I don't know how everyone liked it. And then we didn't get a recommission. Not a recommission. I sort of, my main regret is that we didn't get to make three more.
Yeah.
Because then we'd have six.
Yeah.
And then when you've got six, you can do things a bit more.
It doesn't feel like a taster anymore. Yeah. It feels like that is a finished thing.
It's a series. And we could
even in that first episode, the judges, the acquitted sketch, the Russian roulette sketch, it's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, I really like it. You know, I'm not going to put a counter argument to that. It's brilliant. No, but it's not brilliant. But what I would say is, I think just even quite objectively and not emotionally, I think we did a good enough job for it to be called a pilot. I think there was enough there for people to think, I think that these guys might be able to make something, might be able to do the other three. And so that was what. Annoyed me, and I still don't know. We never had a bit.
It wasn't like a series producer moved on, or the commissioner changed jobs, or something.
There's always people moving, so there was maybe a bit of movie, but also there was never a moment where someone said to us, the four of us in a room, "This is why."
Mm.
And that was a slight frustration that actually there was not, after it had gone out, that was the end of Cowards. That was it. I mean, you didn't know at the time. You had this moment where it goes out and we were like really, really pleased with it and obviously enjoyed the fact that some people said they liked it. But what was quite weird is that it only became apparent as the years went on that it's not going to happen again. Mm. You know, there was like 3 months later, 6 months later, and then you realise 3 years later that was a bit of a time where we made that rather than I wonder if we'll be able to make more. So it's all kind of, it's all done now, and it is quite, yeah, it's like I say, that the headline news is I'm glad that we got that far rather than not be able to make three, because it would be nice to be able to watch those, you know, in 10 years time we did make those things. But yeah, I'd say on balance, it wouldn't have felt weird for them to give us three more. Certainly, would have felt like that was probably a fairly sane thing to do. And so, you know, then you sort of watch other things, and you sort of go, "Oh well," because you know a lot of other things get to make, you know, a whole series, mm-hmm. or then more than one series. But I think it's probably not healthy to even start thinking. Sometimes you can't help it. There's something that's you're watching, you think, oh, God. But actually, I don't really have many of those moments. I think I did at the time, but I think now that we're very lucky to have that shared experience together. And, you know, we did... At the end of the day, no one's going to... Even if we've made six, no one would have watched all six, probably. So we do have, like, a show, a live show we were really proud of, a radio show we were really proud of, and a TV show we were really proud of, which is, like, that's quite a good thing to have looking yeah. back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last question. Thank yeah. you. Thank you. That's. I feel it's not bleak. And like most of the things we've talked about in the negative, yeah. you do sound very philosophical about it and very balanced. And...
Well, totally. But that's the thing. And it drives you on to different things. You know, I think if we'd been able to make more, that was in about 2008, 2009, something like that. Then, I mean, a lot of my life stuff is born out of being available to do it, being free to do it. Mm. And so, you know, it may have been that if we'd done that for the next... It would have been a very different thing. If we'd done that for the next 5 years, let's say if we'd done it then for... We'd got to make the other three. Then we got to make another six. And then maybe it had been put onto BBC Two.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's a very different life.
Yes,
everything's
yes.
different.
Yeah, of course.
Like, we'd be famous... Be like peculiar.
Yeah,
it would be. Yeah,
and which if you'd been famous, you maybe couldn't have taken the same risks that you took, or you know the.
No, that's a good thing. I was saying.
Yeah.
Could easily have taken the same risks. It's famous, don't matter.
Final question, yeah. And I haven't asked this question before. I don't quite know what it is, so I'm just going to rough it out. You are someone, I think, who, like Stuart Lee and Simon Munnery and people of that ilk, people describe you as a genius. What is it that you're doing differently to a lot of other people? What is it? What's the core of your approach that is that is different?
Oh, no, that is not too bad to answer. Because there's no... The problem with, like, when you frame it with saying that I'm a genius, which... I would probably argue a bit much. I would say that, but in terms of approach, I can answer that. That whatever, you know, however my sort of my stuff is just entirely down to, you know, just being just luck, really, and just getting buffeted in various different directions. So there's no kind of, I'm sure that the same with any. Comedians who you know it's very nice for you to rate what I do, but with any of that you rate, it's just them finding their way, isn't it? And just maybe mine's a bit peculiar because it took a bit of time to work out an avenue that suited me and that I could do, and maybe that has a knock-on effect that sometimes some of what I do is a bit curious. Because the end of the day, I started the first time I did stand-up with a microphone in a place, it was stand-up, and it was absolutely rubbish. So maybe that's a part of my getting to where I have got to. I've been fortunate that I wasn't mediocre at stand-up. I was terrible. Like, it was untenable. And not that mediocre in stand-up is a good or a bad thing, but if I'd managed to find my way in there, I might still have been able to sort of, you know, then gradually unlock it and work out how to do it properly and get better and better at it. But I think having to actually come away from it completely and literally just sort of go, I don't know how to do it, and... You know, at the time it's quite difficult because you're in your mid-20s and you're thinking, well, I've had a little go there at being a comedian and that hasn't quite worked out, which is quite demoralising.
Mm.
But then on the back of that, you move into other things. And the fact that I couldn't do it meant that I worked with Alex as his little assistant, worked with Mark as his little assistant, worked with Mark as a double act and stuff like that. Just did really inconsequential but fun things with friends. And I suppose that has probably been, well, that's a useful thing as well, that I've had a lot of friends who, in other news, were really talented, which I sensed at the time. But like Alex and, you know, the other guys from Cowards and Basden and Mark, I got to work with them a lot, where maybe if I'd sort of gone off and done my own thing, I might not have, you know, had as much practice trying to work out what were my strengths and what I could do on stage. So I don't know the answer to your question. And also your question is very problematic. But I think that that probably contributes to what the stuff that I do now is the fact that I did go through this sort of route of being appalling, then becoming a nonsense boy, and then getting better at being a nonsense boy, and then at the end of it, getting paid for it. Which is kind of where I am now, is doing my live stuff and working with Alex, just like always, but now professionally, and working with Basden, just like, you know, in my mid-20s, for no money. Now that's what we do. I think at the time it's quite difficult and quite a lot of fending off questions from my parents about exactly how my life was going, but actually it probably did no harm to actually me as a comedian to have those kind of, to sort of enter that really peculiar and indefinable labyrinth that I was in from then onwards, really, still in. Yeah, it's kind of a peculiar route, which probably helps to, which probably feeds into having a sort of fairly, I guess, peculiar, like certainly stage persona, and you know, I guess it feeds into everything as me as a comedian.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks. Thanks for coming to my flat.
That was Tim. Many thanks to Tim for coming along and doing the show. I'm very pleased to announce that Nick Mohammed is going to be my guest next week. I'm meeting him on Monday to record that interview, so you'll have that next Thursday or Friday. And you're going to love Nick Mohammed. Yeah, now's your time to do your research. He has got some great stuff online, and he is, again, like Tim, he's an innovator, and he's responsible for some really exciting comedy. And also, much like Tim, he manages to walk the line really invigoratingly between brand new, fresh comic ideas and absolute silliness, like bewildering silliness. So Nick Mohammed coming up soon. Thanks to Tim. Thanks to you for listening. Do give us a 5-star review on iTunes if you fancy. If you're passing through that way, you can listen to the show on Stitcher as well. I think they've probably got some sort of equivalent ratings thing. Share it with a friend. Donate at comedianscomedian.com, or just tell people in the street how great it is and graffiti it on buses using a coin rubbed several times against the window. I feel like part of me should go, don't actually do that. None of you are actually going to do that. Do it. Don't do it. Do it. Thanks very much for listening, and come and see some stuff. If you're in Estonia, please do come along to the Estonian Comedy Festival. If you're in or near Wales, anywhere in Britain, come to the Secret Welsh Comedy Festival, end of April, beginning of May. I will see you there.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.